Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So this is a very exciting point in the recording where I'm looking at five glasses of wine that I'm very excited to taste. And we're going to be talking about cellar work and winemaking and that bottling that was mentioned earlier that I'm very intrigued by. I have five glasses in front of me, a very pretty rosé, which is called Castagnato. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Yeah. Very bright kind of jewel-like tones, and a couple of Chardonnays and a couple of Pinot Noirs. And I was just told that typically the tasting starts with the reds, which is very unusual. You know, I sometimes do it just to kind of keep my palate in shape, and, you know, I go back and forth. But what is the reason for typically starting it that way?
Well, just because generally the Chardonnays will have a little bit more acid to them, and mm-hmm. so, you know, if you do that first, then going into the Pinots, sometimes the acids can kind of tire out the palate a little bit. So we like to do the Pinots first, get some of those, you know, get it going, sort of liven up the palate, get everything working, and then kind of go back into the Chardonnays and zip it up a little bit. And
that is such a cool way of doing it.
It's a little bit harder on glasses and glassware, but other than that, I think it's the right way to do it.
Yeah, no, I learned something. See, it's like we talk about, you learn something all the time.
Yeah, with the Chardonnay vineyards that we're working with, they have fairly low natural pHs, mm-hmm. and they can sometimes, you know, if you're doing a flight of maybe six or seven Pinots, it's the first two that tend to, it kills the tannins, mm-hmm. and it just... So when we do the tastings, and they've kind of employed this here even at the Adobe, because it is a good talking point, why the winemakers like to taste the Pinots first, you know, mm-hmm. Because we want to get those tannins, we want to get the mouthfeel, the balance of those wines, before we put the Chardonnays in our mouth and get a good whack of acidity that is part of the style of the wines.
It's really good to know. And I'm staring at this rosé. It's just so darn pretty. I mean, I know you're not supposed to pay that much attention to the color, but I'm totally attracted.
I think it's
now a must. I can't control myself, clearly.
Well, it's actually something that we actually do start with here at the Adobe when we go through our tastings. It's our greeting wine. So when people come to the door, we'll hand them some rosé and, you know, give them a little tour of the place. But the Castagnatas are wines. We make three wines that are Castagnatas. And this is the rosé. We make a Castagnato red as well as a Castagnato white. They're all Rhone wines. So the red is Syrah, Grenache, and it also has about 30% white field blend.
Oh, interesting.
White field blended within that. So that's always a really interesting one. But this Castagnato rosé is made from that fruit. We pull off some, and it's just a really nice way to kind of start your tasting here at the Adobe. And one thing that's pretty cool when you do the tasting here is there is a little bit of California history that we go through, and the Adobe is a historical property. Mm-hmm. The reason that we named them the Castagnatas is that one of our first owners of the house here was Don Juan Castagnato.
So how cool
is
that?
It's kind of an homage to that.
And he was part of the Mexican army. And at the time in 1842, when these houses were built, California didn't become a state till 1865. So it was still occupied. It was part of Mexican territory. And the Mexican government was trying to basically get a much stronger hold with their military in Northern California.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that the weather here may have played part of it. It was just so far away from Mexico City that, you know, eventually California became its own entity. But, you know, in 1842, they built something like 20 of these or 25 of these Adobe homes or spec homes for their officers. And the guy that that got our home was Don Juan Castagnana.
Very cool. And that bottle design is so cool. I have to, again, there'll be pictures posted, so
well, yeah.
Don't let your heart be troubled. You must see that bottle shape.
The bottle's cool too. Yeah, we when they went through and were renovating the Adobe, they went and did some archaeological digs in the back because mm-hmm. they were finding little artifacts and things, and so they stopped, you know, construction and brought in, you know, they were sifting through all, and what they found was in our backyard here, it was sort of the town dump at the time. So there were all these medicine bottles and, you know, various horseshoes and all sorts mm-hmm, of different things, mm-hmm. which we actually have some inside. We saved some of those things to showcase as yeah. a little sort of museum piece. But so that bottle is, for those who can't see it, it's a sort of a whiskey-shaped bottle. And for the rosé and our white wine, we have it in a clear flint glass. And then for our red, it's a darker antique green. So
yeah.
just well, kind we of found similar whiskey bottles.
Mm-hmm. It's
so
really
that was
cool.
The idea was to kind of pay homage to the whole community here
yeah,
in, no, that, in Sonoma.
It's creative. It's, the historical references are absolutely fascinating. And the wine, I mean, the first thing that shows up is that really, you said racy acidity earlier.
Yeah.
That's definitely a perfect descriptor here. Beautiful, bright, brilliant acidity. I've said that in the past. I'm just going to repeat that I'm a very tough customer when it comes to rosé because there's an awful lot of mediocrity in that category, seems like. So I'm tough to please, and this is really delicious.
Thank you.
So it's not just bleed. It's not
yeah.
just Sangiovese.
It's not a Sangiovese.
Yeah. No, yeah. there is some Sangiovese in
okay.
there. And then there's actually some Pinot Sangiovese in there too. But we also take dry red mm-hmm. from the Castagnana and yeah. back blend it. So we get mm-hmm. a little bit of tan. And Ryan also, the first couple of years, we bled the tanks like almost immediately
okay.
and realized that wasn't, you just get this kind of insipid kind of wine. And we ended up back blending more of the dry red. So Ryan now waits a couple days during the cold soak and you get more of those flavors. And
it definitely has beautiful texture.
Just, I think it has such a better
really,
line of aromatics.
Absolutely. No, the aromatics are off the charts and it's such a complete wine. And what mm-hmm. you describe mm-hmm. vis-a-vis the process makes sense now because it's not a rosé and that's all it is. It really is a wine that happens to be a rosé.
And what's really fun about it is, you know, we have that Syrah and Grenache that come from the mm-hmm. you know, from the red, but we also have those whites sort of intermingled. And you, yeah. since it's 30% of that blend to start with, you really get some. There's some Viognier in there, so some real subtle hints of that on the back end, mm-hmm. Marsan and Roussan, and some Grenache Blanc that just kind of give it a little vivaciousness. You know, it's a little some of the bright components. So it's not.
You know, it just dawned on me that if it was poured in a black glassware and I was asked what wine it is, I would not have said rosé.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would have probably gone with a white Rhone blend of some type.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
clear. But yeah. that would be the only thing I could call. I couldn't call the color.
Yeah.
It's a compliment, yeah. actually.
No,
yeah, no, I agree. And that's what we like about, and I think our consumers like about the aromatics. And
yeah.
It's just that little bit of white. And same thing in the Castagnana red. It just... It's not your classic kind of Syrah and Grenache dry
wow.
red wine.
We say that all the time with the Castagnana red is that if you put it in a black glass and had someone smell it, you know you're getting just minor hints of those whites coming through,
mm-hmm.
and you it's always it, and then you taste it and okay, now it's a red wine, obviously.
Sure.
But on the nose, it's a tricky fun little wine.
It's a bit chameleonic, which again is a testament to your winemaking and intentionality to what you do. What a great beginning. I know that we're going backwards, so I will propose that we're going to Chardonnays, probably because I've never had the One Sky Chardonnay. This would be my first. I'm dying to try it, so a bit of a selfish reason. It's literally, I'm not sure how long you guys have been making this bottling, but I mm-hmm. hadn't had an opportunity to try it. So looking forward
yeah.
to hearing about it and tasting it?
Yeah, so so it's actually
the middle one.
Yeah,
the middle one. Got it.
So that's the One Sky Chardonnay is from our One Sky vineyard, which is on the top of Sonoma Mountain.
Yep.
Right next to Vanderkamp Vineyard.
So oh, got it.
If you go up Sonoma Mountain Road, it's facing northeast. So it's right in it, but it's right at the top. It's about 1,300 feet, so it's the highest vineyard on Sonoma Mountain. And as we were talking about soils earlier, it's a this real volcanic soil, and you know, iron rich, and it's very steep. The whole thing is just, some of it's 25% grade, where yeah.
We're not sure how they pick it, to be honest with you.
Tractors,
you have to go down. You have to drive yeah. around the back and come down. You don't want to drive up.
Yeah, it's...
Wow.
Yeah.
I've actually been to Vanderkamp. And so I can kind of picture what you're describing. And
so,
yes.
Yeah, just keep following. Yeah, it's... So Vanderkamp's kind of flat.
It is.
But then when you look up,
it's just kind of like this.
Yeah.
It's almost an L shape.
That's...
Is what I'm seeing in my mind's eye.
Right.
So that's a tough proposition.
It is. And you know, it's a vineyard that... It's a fun vineyard for us because this is one of our vineyards that we're farming organically now.
Wow.
And really just trying to, you know, learn what, you know, how we can make organic farming work, up there. It's a unique site, both with aspect and soil, and take some of those things and apply them out to,
yeah.
to all of our other vineyards as well.
Wow.
And it's so the One Sky, Bill has a home up there as well, so it's okay. kind of their backyard, and and it's a special place, and the Chardonnay that comes off of it is on that steepest part, so mm-hmm. we get these really small berries. It's a Wente clone, so
okay.
you get this nice intensity of fruit, and it's so cold up there. And it's warm in the daytime because of that sort of that aspect, but it cools down really quickly because of our elevation up there. So you get these really intense, concentrated fruits in the wine. And we have another vineyard that we pull a little bit of fruit off of for this wine, just as we're continuing to sort of grow it. And it's such a fun wine that, you know, has, I think, you know, when you look at sort of all of our Chardonnays, this one sits sort of in the middle as far as, you know, one of the wines is a little bit more delicate and sort
yeah.
of mineral. This is kind of right in the middle where you
yeah.
get some nice delicate aromas, but some depth and complexity as you go. And some of our other wines are even, you know, maybe even a little bit bigger.
Wow. No, this definitely smells and tastes like a classic, even though it's 2017 and quite young.
Yeah.
But it's, again, a bit chameleonic because it has the new world, the California sunlight, and just this beautiful, complex fruit. But it also has this minerality and salinity that I associate often with the old world. Was that intentional?
Yeah. That is intentional with okay. clone rootstock, and even we're on the north side of the northern face mm-hmm. vineyard, which I wasn't when Bill first showed it to me. I was like, really, you put Chardonnay on the north side of Sonoma Mountain? And I think it was one of the brilliant choices that he's done. And it just gives you, I think as these vines age, will give us even more complexity. These are relatively young vines. We've only been getting the fruit 4 or 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
No, that's, like I said, just popped into my head, classic, and it's completely organic.
Yeah.
For me, because you can't help but admire the fact that it sort of skates the line of hedonism and pleasurable qualities, and also the classic, age-worthy ones. It's not easy to achieve.
Well, I think we've done it again with oak.
Yeah.
It's only around 30%, 25 to 30% new oak. It's all barrel fermented. In the case of the Chardonnays, we don't use any SO2 until after malolactic.
Hmm.
So what that allows to happen is the juice naturally hyperoxidates.
Yeah.
All that browning component comes out before the fermentation, And then we let the native ferments kind of take off and kind of treat those as a controlled fermentation as much as we can.
Absolutely.
And then the 17s, we learned not to stir quite as much. We'd kind of been over stirring, I think, with the 16s. That was one technique. Maybe we went a little too far. And it's just being patient with the wine. And then we've been able now to bottle all of the Chardonnays here unfiltered. Mm. We haven't had to filter any of the shards. And I think that makes a difference in the texture of the wine, you know, for the consumer.
Yeah, no, the mid palate is fantastic. I wouldn't be afraid to lay it down, but I'm not a very patient person. I'd be tempted to drink it quickly. And what an inspiring story about the site, because truly,
it's a great site.
And wines are, in fact, stories waiting to be uncovered, especially the good and great wines deliver a lot. And just picturing in my mind again, where I think it's located, just from traveling to that neck of the woods, that's quite an undertaking. And look at the result. There's just so much pleasure in this glass of wine and hard work that you just described, and all those decisions, the minute details that we talked about earlier that made the difference in the end. I can taste the intentionality. So
thank you. Wonderful. It's such a great site, and as we move on to the next one is another great site.
Yes.
And one that's probably more traditionally known for Pinot Noir, Gap's Crown.
Yes, the Gap's Crown.
So, we were it was probably our first
couple
year.
Months.
Yeah. First few months when we were here, mm-hmm. We did one of these big lunches with all of Bill and sort of the extended team.
Yeah.
And we were going through, and we had tasted a wine from Gap's Crown. It was a Chardonnay that Gavin Shannon had made from Ludum. Mm-hmm. And we were tasting, this is delicious. What is it? And let's look a little bit deeper. And it just had such vibrant sort of acidity and minerality, but mm-hmm. still had some nice, really nice fruit to it. So we talked to Rob.
Wow.
Said,
"Yeah, we
can we get some of this? We need to make some Chardonnay off of Gaps. Before then hadn't made Chardonnay from Gaps, and it's about Gaps Crown is about 130 acres total, mm-hmm. and about 100 acres is Pinot. So there's mm-hmm. about 30 acres of Chardonnay, but it didn't have the history of the Pinot Noirs, and we said this is something that could be really special, and it has a little bit different profile. It's a little bit more minerality. If you're sort of thinking in the old world terms, I would say it's more Chablis-like than anything.
Yeah.
It's got more citrus and kind of saline than it does fruit. Whereas the One Sky and even Durell, we find some more of those stone fruits, pear, peach.
No, it's a completely different experience aromatically.
Very different clones. These mm-hmm. are both just Dijon clones. Mm. I believe 124 is a Dijon clone.
Yep. So at this site, at Gap's Crown, it's our coldest site of all. So, even with Sonoma Mountain being really high, and with our Wallala Vineyard, which is far, far Sonoma Coast up near Annapolis, Gap's, because of the Petaluma Gap, is the coldest of all. And so mainly Dijon clones are planted out there, both in Pinot and Chardonnay. And it was done for a reason, because those tend to do better in those cooler climates, and but also offer that minerality and that sort of a little more flintiness.
It's a dead ringer for Grand Cru Burgundy. It's the acidity, that minerality, that textural elements. This is really serious effort. And for those of you that haven't seen any images or obviously have been to the coastline, it's one of the most dramatic places in the world, in my opinion, Wallala specifically. It's a rugged coastline.
Yeah.
Really interesting growing conditions, I'm sure, ensues from that. So when you said that, again, I had this mental image of what it's like for those grapes to survive even and thrive in this kind of situation.
Thing about Gap's Crown is it's so, the elevation is so much lower. It's only a couple hundred feet, whereas Annapolis has got to, or Wallala's got to be up around 1,100 to maybe 1,400 feet.
Yeah.
So at Gap's, especially where the Chardonnay is down on the lower part, it sits in the fog in the, in like when it's in late September, early October. So we're always kind of sweating bullets when it comes to botrytis.
Ah.
And that's where canopy management comes in, you know, and we'll go to Rob. We've learned now, it's like, okay, let's start taking shoots and leaves a little bit sooner. Let's slow down the disease pressure so that when we get to harvest, and the skins will acclimate to the direct sunlight, so when we get closer to harvest, we're not just stripping things at that point and frantically trying to get things done. So I think with the 17, you know, we farmed, that was the third season we had been farming it together, and I think we came up with some good habits that really show well in the wines.
Yeah, that vineyard work definitely paid off from, again, what I'm tasting. These are very exciting. I'm so glad that you're making, that you have a Chardonnay program, because I know that, you know, obviously, that wine country that I was, we were just discussing how well it's known for Pinot Noirs, and Chardonnay sometimes get overlooked a little bit, and that's too bad because what I'm tasting is so significant.
Oh no, we have some great Chardonnays here in Sonoma County, I think. Yeah. I think we sell a lot of Chardonnay to Napa County. Put it that way.
Yes.
And there's a reason why.
Yes. Yeah. No, these are very impressive. And again, such young wines, 2017.
Just now being released.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they're just like, I think if you came to the Adobe, this would be the tasting, like, right now. So.
Yeah. And they're showing so well.
Yeah, it's important, I think, that they're approachable. You know, it is definitely something that that always goes through our heads when making these wines, is how do we make them, they just have to be ready right when they get released. You know, we don't want them to be ready any day sooner, because we want that longevity as well. We want these to be able to be put down and laid down. And
these are going to taste great though in 5 7
I
years
can only imagine.
Seriously, they'll fill out the middle a little bit more, and these wines will. 17 was a good vintage for us. I know not everybody had as good a time as we did, I think. But just because we could farm our fruit, and we were able to. The 17s were really about two vintages. Kind of, we had that big heat spell right around Labor Day for like six, seven days. So it was either picking fruit before, which we did because we had a lot of young fruit, and then irrigating, adding water, and then waiting it out for like 3 weeks before you started picking again. And we had literally all the red fermenters emptied before we did the second half of our harvest.
Wow, that's quite staggering.
And I think it was prudent that we were able to do that and made a big difference in the wines, because I saw a lot of people panicking around that heat spell, because you know, all of a sudden they saw 27. We had one vineyard that was up over 27 bricks, and we ended up picking it 3 weeks later at 23.3.
Wow.
Just by letting the vines come back to, you know, equilibrium.
You know, again, it's so important. Sometimes, you know, there might be an article or some kind of communication or miscommunication that confuses the bigger picture, meaning please, when you're reading wine press, don't just assume that there's vintage characterizations that apply across the board.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It really is a disservice, because you're not going to then be motivated to try some of the best wines that were made. Those that do the work in the vineyard, like what you describe, and how much time and energy is dedicated to that piece, and how closely it's being watched, produces wines in vintages that are more challenging than others. Are spectacular. So don't let that dissuade you just because somebody said 2017 was a challenging vintage.
Yeah, and I think with that, you also have to realize that oftentimes there's an angle that has to be achieved with a story potentially. So, you know, whether it's the fires or whether it's the heat spike or whatever, but like you said, there's there are people who are doing things around each of those that maybe weren't affected at all. You know, back in 2011, the last difficult year, there were some beautiful wines made that year.
Indeed.
You know, it was so just seek out and find those that have done something interesting. And yeah, on par, on average, you might say it's a lesser vintage, but there are some shining stars within those.
Absolutely. And please be curious. I mean,
you
heard such a compelling case that was made by Bob and Ryan when, because of your curiosity, because you aren't resting on your achievements, you've crafted a career path that's extraordinarily stimulating and rewarding. And you've, you know, created so much joy through the product of wine. It's because of who you are. I mean, it's rooted in the fact that you wanted to pursue it. And please take a lesson from that, because we all could, you know, could be a little more curious and think a little more critically and not just take things at face value, but experiment, you know, just embrace this world. There's so much there.
Absolutely.
It's funny, Ryan brings up the 2011, and I was sitting on a panel, I was still at Williams Selyem, down in San Francisco with a bunch of sommeliers, and I forget who else was, who put it on, but it was all fairly, I was the oldest winemaker by far, and they had all discussed how they used less whole cluster because the stems were greener, and it was a very cold season, and then I kind of threw a wrench in it, because what I did at Williams Selyem is the fruit hung so long in 2011 that we actually did get some lignification. We just didn't get high bricks. So I actually included more stems. I did more whole clusters. So I kind of did the opposite of what these guys had done, because I knew I needed, I wasn't getting the phenolic tannins out of the skins that I needed. So I needed to help balance that out with a little more stem tannin. And I used a fair amount, we used to use a fair amount of oak anyway, but it's all about balancing that vintage with whatever they give you. And the acidities were pretty high that year too. So, you know, you needed some structure in those wines.
Yeah.
And I've recently had a couple of my 2011s, and I really like the way they've turned out. They were tough to drink when they went on release. And I know our marketing guys were not happy with me. But in the end, the wines, you know, really turned out the way I wanted them to turn out. You just had to be patient.
Yeah, and I mean,
and I don't think in California we're patient enough with.
Oh, I think in general,
yeah,
as so, Americans, we're not particularly patient as a society. We want, you know, we age wine in the backseat of the car. And
right.
This is a good case. And it's different functionality. I mean, if your child was born in 2011, why not put some wine in the cellar, and then you'll be forced into discipline by not.
I have a child from 2011, so I've got a bunch of it.
There you go. And actually, there were bargains, because, like you described, unfortunately, you know, there was some negative press and some, you know, wrong perceptions of, you know, baby with the bathwater, essentially, when the whole vintage was kind of.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.